Good evening, Boston. Welcome to BNN News. I'm Faith Amafidon. Thanks for tuning in. This past weekend, South Boston's Ironworkers Local 7 overflowed with camaraderie and laughter at the annual St. Patrick's Day breakfast.
I was born down on A Street, raised up on B Street. Southie is my hometown.
Last Sunday's St. Patrick's Day breakfast did not disappoint. Full of cheer, lively music, and every shade of green you can imagine, the breakfast, which has been a tradition for over a century, has a special meaning for all who are lucky enough to be seated on the dais.
You're supposed to come and roast and make jokes, but at the same time, remind folks about the pride that folks take in Southie, St. Patrick's Day, Evacuation Day. So it's a combination. I love it. It's great to be here, and it's great to actually be able to celebrate with colleagues and have a good time.
I have a little bit of Irish heritage. I'm mostly Italian and Greek, according to my understanding from what I've heard from my family members. My name is Diana DiZoglio, but this month I go by Diana O. DiZoglio to make sure that we have some fun at these events.
It's a great tradition that's gone on for generations. We come together, we celebrate as a community, a city, a state, our Irish heritage, our Irish history, but also get together, have a meal, poke some fun at each other, and just try to really enjoy the day.
It's an honor to be on the dais. It's an honor to try to contribute something to this iconic event, but it is incredibly nerve-wracking. So my favorite part, I think, is when my time at the mic is over and I can go back, return safely to my seat and just share in laughs and be in community with my colleagues.
Ironworkers Local 7 Union served up the intimate venue to celebrate the Irish heritage of the Commonwealth. State leaders and invited guests enjoyed a hearty breakfast served with plenty of good music.
Sheena fina fall, et ofri aul egerin, who at supremely we hail, ever to our lunch, last gleaming.
Senator Nick Collins set the tone with casual banter and tomfoolery, making room for the true main course, the roast of our elected city and state officials.
It is like coming home. You know, my wife frequently tells my girls, when I first met your father, he was an iron worker. Then he went to law school and became a lawyer. Then he went and ran for office and became a politician, she says. It's been one disappointment after another.
We've got a female mayor, a female governor, a female lieutenant governor, four female members of the federal delegation. So I want to say this. Men, please don't get discouraged. One day in our future, maybe not in our lifetime, but our children's children's lifetimes, there may be, once again, room at the top for men.
The North End has always had a really special place in my heart. It's been the site of many of the firsts in my life, and I used to live there. I had my first date with my Italian-American husband there. We had our wedding rehearsal dinner there, celebrated the baptism of our firstborn son there, and recently I was served my first subpoena there. When they gave it to me, I said, "What is this? I thought I ordered the veal milanese." And they said, "You did, but instead we're giving you the vaffanculo."
The three-hour morning put attendees in the best of spirits, and they left feeling like...
We're walking on sunshine. Whoa, the people want sunshine. Whoa, the people want sunshine. Yeah, it's up and feel good.
Kicking off the gardening season, the trustees of Boston hosted the annual Gardeners Gathering, where vendors shared the fruits of their knowledge. Green Thumbs united at Northeastern University for the annual Gardeners Gathering, where the trustees, Boston Community Gardens, and the City of Boston shared the importance of cultivating relationships with land and how that connection leads to food production.
I think for so long we've gone away from nature, and what you're trying to see now is people coming back to nature. So putting their hands in the ground, putting your hands in the ground, you have that instant connection of that sense of belonging, and people are starting to realize that what is the best medicine? The best medicine is to be able to grow your own food and to nourish your own body. So you see so many people now coming back to the land, wanting to grow food. Either it's a community garden, it's on their windowsill, it's on their terraces, it's on their rooftops, because they understand that food is medicine.
It was the day to remember how we get the food that's on our plate. Beekeepers, coffee roasters, and farmers all have a huge role to play in our daily lives, even if we don't realize it.
I grew up in the South, and I grew up eating healthy food. I can't remember my parents going to the store to buy vegetables. I can't remember them going to the store to buy meat, because my grandfather was a farmer and we raised everything. It's essential for us to grow our food for our own health and our children's health.
The trustees believe that community gardening and individual gardening both play a major role in the face of the climate crisis.
I think that one of the things that comes from people growing their own food is that they develop a stronger respect and understanding about what it means, and they start asking questions about other parts of the food system. But at the same time, they're enjoying that tomato or that basil or that callaloo or tulsi that they have grown themselves, that they've brought to their own table, shared with people, and yeah, they got their hands dirty while they were doing it, but they were connecting with the earth. And hydroponics aside, that connection with the earth is what's going to sustain us. And for people to be connected, that's going to get people involved with protecting the earth in so many different ways.
It's so important to be able to dig your fingers into the soil and grow for your own self. You know, grow the food that is culturally relevant to you, and eat fresh and take care of your own health. This food is bringing the community together. It connects you with your friends and your neighbors. It's so important that you are able to connect with the soil and with your outdoors in a way to connect with everybody across the globe that's doing the same and, you know, save this planet together.
The day included over a dozen workshops, exciting exhibitions, networking, and an award ceremony to recognize community gardens on their contribution to their neighborhoods. Gore Street Garden of Jamaica Plain was named Rookie of the Year. Participants were happy to walk away with a new plant and new knowledge about the importance of growing your own food.
We're a step closer to a Green New Deal paradise as the city takes bold steps in climate action, turning its attention to reducing energy consumption and the carbon footprint of Boston's current affordable housing.
If the new Green Deal proponents have their way, this will soon be a scene of the past. In Allston last Thursday, Mayor Wu announced city plans to enhance energy efficiency in Boston by reducing greenhouse emissions in our buildings.
Here in Boston, buildings are our biggest source of pollution and emission. They account for nearly three-quarters of the city's annual emissions. So one of the most important things we can do is to take decisive climate action in ensuring that our buildings meet the highest emission standards. In that spirit, today we're announcing two new strategies to make Boston the country's leading Green New Deal city. The first is an ordinance that we'll file with the Boston City Council on Monday to adopt a new green building code that strengthens energy efficiency requirements across our city and across our Commonwealth. And the second is a new large building green energy retrofits program offered through the Office of Housing.
We need to dramatically reduce the amount of energy that we use and eliminate fossil fuels. The specialized stretch energy code creates much more efficient buildings with a simpler code that will ensure that new buildings in Boston are all electric or electric ready on day one. The retrofit program will provide deep energy retrofits that residents are going to feel on hot days and cold days and on the days that they pay their electric bills. Efficiency means removing fossil fuels becomes easier and more affordable.
Funded by the American Rescue Plan Act, the mayor's new large building green energy retrofits program will provide $50,000 per unit to income-restricted buildings with 15 or more units for green updates.
These measures include upgrades to doors and windows to be more energy efficient, replacement of HVAC systems, installation of solar panels, and more. These changes will go a long way in counteracting some of the effects climate change has already brought. But more importantly, it will reduce air pollution and improve health outcomes in our most vulnerable communities.
We know that the climate crisis isn't just coming, it's here already. And it's leading to warmer summers. We've had these heat waves. We have these cold snaps. All of those are challenging, not just from a climate perspective, but also from a safety perspective. And so we're really excited about these retrofits because it will both mean that these units will be greener, but it also means that people will be more comfortable and more safe as our weather is sort of going up and down in sort of sometimes unpredictable ways.
And another win for the affordable housing movement, Estonia Apartments, a residential building that offers low-income housing, just received a grant that will ensure modernization and quality. On Monday, Mayor Michelle Wu and state leaders announced that $1.75 million in federal grants will be invested in upgrading Estonia Homes, an apartment complex for low-income seniors and disabled residents in the North End.
Thanks to our federal delegation, the seniors and residents with disabilities living here at Ausonia in the North End will have access to safe, healthy, comfortable housing that is permanently affordable.
The grants will make energy-efficient climate retrofits and necessary upgrades possible, like air quality improvement, accessibility measures that secure affordable housing, and essential maintenance.
These changes add up to safer, healthier, and more affordable housing that improves not only the quality of the spaces, but the quality of life for all of those who call them home.
Upgrades to the 100-unit public housing received widespread support from both the federal and local levels.
Public housing is the backbone of our housing. You know, making sure we have everyone has a decent roof over their shoulder is important for us to provide and move forward with this discussion. We can't fix the crisis unless we're taking care of all our people in this Commonwealth.
Because of our partnerships with the city, we are celebrating $1.75 million in funding to complete essential maintenance and invest in energy efficient climate retrofits at the Estonia Apartments. In advancing the vision for a cleaner and greener city, Commonwealth, and nation, we can and we must ensure all people, no matter their age, race, income, or disability, are part of that vision.
The project is not only about improving the building, but also investing in the North End community and ensuring everyone has the resources to thrive.
It's just so critical that we invest in the resource of public housing. I mean, these are beautiful, thriving communities, but the infrastructure and the buildings are aged and they have a lot of needs. And so investing in Estonia Apartments today is really, you know, just a commitment to the future of the building and of the residents and of this community. And this is one of the only affordable places in the North End for seniors and disabled folks to live. And so we want to make sure that carries forward, not only for the current residents, but for future low-income residents.
Michael Patrick Murphy is an author with strong roots in South Boston, whose grandmother told him of the city's history, and his great-grandfather, Boston City Councilor Michael Mahoney, taught him about his Irish heritage. Murphy originally wrote his debut novel, Neighborhood Lines, while in college at UMass Boston, finally publishing it in 2018. In 2022, he created an audio version of Neighborhood Lines, and in 2023, this year, published its sequel, Redeem the Lines. We were thrilled to have Murphy return to BNN to discuss his new book, exploring race, class, corruption, and the common ground that can be achieved by working together to overcome difficulties of adverse environments. Here's our conversation. So I want to get us started with the experience of writing this sequel. What were you excited to dive back into? What new topics were you looking to explore this time around?
I just wanted to see these guys come out of their age range in the first book, which was 17 and 18, and then into the real world, out of high school, into the age of 24, 25, and experiencing what they had left to finish together as a group, as a friendship, and as individuals. So it's been long overdue, but I was very excited to finish it. Yes.
And these two young men, they've gone through quite a lot. When we see Patrick again at the start of this book, he's newly released from prison after serving 4 years out of a 5-year sentence for a crime that he didn't commit on top of that. Can you talk about the changes that we see in Patrick coming out of prison and this new South Boston that he's reemerging into?
Yeah, in the Irish community forever, it's the code of silence, as well as most communities, whether that's in the North End or even in the Black community, you know, snitching is not accepted. So he kept his mouth shut. He went to prison for a crime that was made of an example. It was a hate crime. He didn't have, he was there, but he didn't do the action. And so as he gets out, he just wants a fresh start at life. He just wants to start over. He had a good high school life and education. And he faces a whole new city. The city had just, Whitey Bulger had just left the city, and heroin and crack has been, you know, writ all around the projects, all around all the neighborhoods of Boston, and he's seeing what he doesn't identify. He's, wow, what happened in the past 5 years? So he doesn't really know how to fit in at first, and he's trying to get accustomed to it.
All right, so you spoke earlier about snitching, the code of silence, and that's something that we see happen throughout the book. We see it, how Patrick and Nate, they struggle with it in their own ways in their adult life. We also see you draw some interesting parallels between their snitching and the code of silence that we see in the police community. Why is it so hard to tell the truth?
Well, most people in these situations become either excommunicated or threatened violently if you do rat, as they say. And this book uses some real-life events throughout the whole entire novel, as we've discussed. And there are two police brutality cases inside this novel that happens, one to the white character and the other to the Black character. And one of them is very real and known throughout the city that you can identify with. And the snitching and ratting just didn't exist. And it affected a lot of people in these experiences and in these cases.
And what I loved about the book is that you paint a really vivid picture of the city in the mid-90s. It's a Boston that... it seems like wild when I think about where we are now. And you also show how the city, South Boston, Roxbury, was ravaged by drugs, by heroin, by crack. And you mentioned some real-life tragedies that happened during that time, such as the murder of 9-year-old Jermaine Goffigan, or the shooting of Tiffany Moore. Mm-hmm. What about that time really stands out to you?
Yeah, as a kid, I was in high school with my friend who was based on Nate, and we would be in school and waking up and early in the morning and reading the newspaper before class, and these murders and these horrific events that would happen to the innocent were shocking, and that was in the Black community. It would just be really heart-pulling to him and to me, and then you go on to the white neighborhood of South Boston, and there were kids committing suicide because they were hooked on the pain pills and the new OxyContins that had just flooded the city. And, you know, I would experience friends or family's friends that a kid had committed suicide or he OD'd, and it just blew my mind that it was happening. And so it really was something that I never forgot, and that's why I wanted to put this in the book and kind of show these experiences in the community, in our culture, in a society that actually happened, that are now almost re-happened, right? The racial conflict and now the different drugs that hit the city and how much they're rampant now and people are overdosing. So it's just a cycle that I wanted to really point out in our culture. So it may be different, but yet it's somewhat similar that we experience now and what we experienced then. Hmm.
And in addition to this history that you're educating us on in Boston, you also introduce us to really wonderful characters that we don't see in the first book. Who are a couple of the characters that really resonate with you?
Oh, there's so many. I love and I enjoyed every one of them. But Papa Ray, we discussed that. He was a boxing coach from Roxbury who was friends with my boxing trainer, Jimmy Farrell. And these guys are, having a boxing gym and having kids from the different communities get together, work in a gym, fight together. And they really had a lot of peace in that gym, and a lot of friendships were built there. And I think that that's a great lesson for the city and of the story. The Boston police officers that are in the story, they're great characters. They walk both sides of the line trying to get into the different neighborhoods and then also try to do their jobs correctly. And then the priest, Reverend Gibbs, who is a leader of the 10-Point Coalition, as well as Father Moran, who was the creator of the integration program where Nate and Patrick met. So all these characters, and the mothers, I'd have to say Patrick's mother is a great character, and Nate's mother is so set on seeing him do great and to go to college. And so you have every layer of character, the criminals, the cops, the priests, the moms, the fathers, they're great characters, yeah.
I love that. And earlier this month, you had the chance to go to the Boys and Girls Club of Dorchester and share excerpts of the book with some of the young teens there. And you did so with Cornell Mills, who was the inspiration for Nate.
Yes.
Was it hard for them to grasp the Boston that you depicted in this book? I'm also wondering, what would you say the struggles that they're dealing with now?
Yeah, I think I think we had a great time. I'm wearing the Boys and Girls Club of Dorchester sweatshirt, and the staff really enjoyed that we were there and got the students, the youth to open up and talk to Cornell and I sitting in front of them. The differences is that we didn't have social media. That was the one major difference that I think they have versus what we didn't have. And we were looking at the city of Boston, and that was in the Herald or the Globe, and that's what our news was. And now they're exposed to every minute global information, and it's targeted towards them. So I think there's a much different exposure to the world that they have than we had. But the city is similar, and the enclaves, the neighborhood enclaves, are still there, and some of them have gentrified, as we've discussed, and have changed. But I think the fact that we were able to connect to them was the greatest experience that I've had in writing these books. Cornell and I had a wonderful time, and we want to do more of it, and talk to different schools and have the real conversation. What are your thoughts? What are you feeling? What are your dreams? And what do you think holds you back? And having those, and what do you feel about the racial conflict in this world? And things like that. And having those conversations allows for changing your mindset, opening up, and really does well for healing and creating a better future.
Arts Emerson is excited to welcome back director, choreographer, and artistic visionary Raphael Boitel to its stage with her newest piece, Shadows Cast, which will run 5 performances only from March 30th through April 2nd. At age 6, Boitel started acting, and 2 years later, she joined the École Nationale des Arts du Cirque. Her career has spanned theater, film, TV, and the circus. Boitel joined us for a conversation about secrets and the vision behind Shadows Cast. Shadows Cast is an impressive mixture of acrobatics, acting, and performance art. Where did you get the inspiration for this very unique show?
Well, from a lot of things, mainly from cinema. That's my first source of inspiration. And I wrote this show really in a way of a fiction, but then it's, you know, as you said, it's a mix, it mixes the disciplines. So it really mixes the dance, the aerial dances, acrobatics, and very physical. And there is a lot of emotion that goes through the body, but really talking about something, talking about this family story. So yeah, it's all of that.
In 2019, you premiered When Angels Fall, which first delighted Arts Emerson audiences. What themes from that show are you continuing to explore in Shadows Cast, and in what ways are they different?
Yeah, well, it's different, but it's really, of course, you know, I have a vision that I developed since many years, and it's a language, it's a physical language that is really emotional also. And in fact, When Angels Fall, it was talking about the society, about the world, about, you know, my feeling and of what was going on in the world and maybe imagining this future. And so it's a show that it's talking about, you know, the society, but always with a lot of visual, a lot of poetry, a lot of physical aptitude. And when Shadows Cast, it's the continuity of it. But now I wanted to go more into an intimate subject. I wanted to talk about the family that we can all identify. And so it's, you know, you can feel all the same energy of visual and beauty and grace and acrobatics, but then it goes even more and deeper in the person, you know, in the intimacy of human beings. And here it's talking about this family story and about a secret that is very, yeah.
And before you started directing, you enjoyed a very rich career as an actor and an acrobatic performer. What prompted your transition to directing, and what aspects of your performance life are you pulling on to serve you in this directing role?
You know, I've been doing this work since so many years, since I'm a child, and it's wonderful, but it's difficult also. And I really, you know, you need a lot of perseverance to do this. Also as a woman, and I began very early to be a director. So I began when I was a performer, in fact, I began, I was 13 years old. So I have a whole life, a whole career as an interpret, as an actress. And very young, actually, I needed to express my vision of my, you know, the world, of my feelings, and all of this vision that really mixes disciplines. And it was not easy to go from, you know, being an actress or interpret and become a director, also as a woman, a young woman. It took time. And so it really, I would say the word perseverance, one of my show talks about it actually. And you have to fight a lot, but then we have so many moments of grace that my English sometimes I need to. But yes, perseverance and. But I began since I'm so young, so it's, you know, it's just all my life. And actually at the first, when I was very small, I wanted to do cinema, and then I did circus, dance, all of that. And so now I am what I did also. And yeah, I'm so happy now to be able to express my vision of different subjects.
And finally, what do you hope that the audiences take away from Shadows Cast?
Well, I hope that they will think about it, that they will, you know, we are here also to give beauty to the audience, to give hope, to give dreams, but also to, yeah, as I said, open up a dialogue with your own family. If you have, you know, things that are here and you never talk about it, just talk about it. And maybe it's going to be better if you talk about it. Sometimes we just don't talk and we keep everything here and we get a bit blocked in life. So my message would be, you know, just open yourself, open up a dialogue, a communication, and maybe things are going to get better in your life. So that's mainly what I would say. And let's hope and dream together.
For more information on Shadowcast tickets, artsemerson.org. All right, and that's all we have for tonight, Boston. Thank you so much for tuning in. For BNN News, I'm Faith Amafadon, and I will see you next Friday.